Hello, this is Dan. You're listening to Resonant Radio. What follows is my conversation with mycologist and adventure writer, Lawrence Millman. We speak about the science of fungi, indigenous stories, and cannibalism, which no one here supports. I hope you enjoy. Lawrence, where are you today?
I'm sitting in my troglodytic abode in Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA.
Is this a place you've spent a lot of time in? Have you lived here a while?
7 years. I have tended to move around quite a bit, but I have lived in Cambridge off and on for about 30 years. I regard it as a good base camp. Easy access to the airport, easy access to trains. I feel, in a way, it's important to live in a place that's slightly uninteresting. And I prefer nature to the urban world. But if it's slightly uninteresting, I have something to write about, react against. And I think for a writer, that's quite important. If you grow up in paradise, where you could take a trip where nothing goes wrong, your writing is going to be dull.
And so Cambridge offers this type of
stimulus.
Nice.
It does. It's stimulus, and also because I refuse to drive a 2-ton wheelchair, otherwise known as an automobile. And because back going back to my youth, I still refused. And my mother thought I was autistic, which at the time I thought meant a dislike of automobiles. But I did learn to drive. I got a license and drove for some years. I lived in Vermont for a while. But I refuse now to drive cars. I regard them, in one sense, as weapons of mass destruction. When people get in and their mentality changes and they go into metaphoric overdrive in terms of what they're doing and, honkers increasing. It's like a bugle being blown, the advent of a war, repeated honking.
So again, no necessity to drive a car in Cambridge. That's nice. Well, there's a lot of topics you've mentioned that are part of what we've come together to talk about today, starting with fungi, going on to exploring writing, a lot to cover. I would love to start off by asking you a general question. What is something that you have found throughout your travels, your writings, your journeys through the world, something you've found to be true?
That's a very interesting question. I suppose that something I've been found to be true is that, as I sort of semi-indicated to you, and I can only do this in retrospect because at the time I don't think if it's true. Mistakes matter. Because if you make a mistake, then you may think at the time, oh, this is all screwed up. I took the wrong trail. I'm lost. But you can't be found unless you're lost. And here's not a mistake so much. This morning, I was pissed off because a jogger was coming down the sidewalk at me, and I was half tempted. I have a little whistle that I occasionally wear when people speak loudly on their cell phones. And they turned to me and I said, sorry, I don't have a cell phone, so I have to use this whistle instead. But at any rate, the jogger was coming and I didn't whistle, but I dodged out of the way and then looked in mulch and I melted some mulch and I found some very interesting mushrooms I would not have found if I hadn't dodged out of the way. In other words, had he not been jogging directly toward me, I would not have found them. And, you know, I've often thought, you know, it doesn't happen at the time often that, you know, screw up. Like, I often got lost and found really interesting stuff, whereas if I had stuck to the straight and narrow trail, I would not have.
So in this case, the runner's mistake mattered.
The runner mattered. It's something that I briefly reviled now for 30 seconds. It turned out I would not have gone into that little area where there was mulch and found mushrooms.
So you've been traveling the world, especially the Arctic region, for most of your life, and you've written stories. I think you're at 18 books now. Is that right?
I think it's up. It depends on what you call a book, because some of them are like chapbooks.
Okay.
Some of them I have a forthcoming mini memoir called Outsider that's about 60 pages. And whether that qualifies as a book is hard to say, but I'd say 21 altogether.
Suffice it to say, you've written a lot. One of your conclusions that you come to often in your writings, also in your blog posts and more, is that the human effect on the planet, largely, generally, has been disruptive. It has been, we could call it a mistake. It's been something that's been hurtful to the planet. Would this theory apply there as well, that mistakes matter?
No, it wouldn't. Because I'm talking about myself as an individual, making individual mistakes, whereas humanity, a human being who has an offspring, well, that's okay. But if 4 billion human beings have two offspring, that's very different. And I would say mistake would be a very mild word for the overpopulation. I almost think that virtually every problem we have today goes back to overpopulation. Mm-hmm. Too many people. And one of my favorite writers, although he's unknown in the U.S., is a Finnish ecologist named Pentti Linkola, Linkola, who has written quite a bit. I suggest you Google him. He was sometimes called an eco-fascist, since he believed that the only way to control the planet now is cruelty. You need some ecologically minded dictator who can say, no, you can't do that. But he also said, and I'm not sure I support this exactly, but given the fact that some individuals call me a Luddite, which is absolutely wrong because I'm not an end-weaver. He said that all inventions since 1914 should be abolished. And that there should only be public transportation, cars, no, buses, trains, yes, and boats and ferries, yes.
So the folks who have called you a Luddite might also have called you a misanthrope, someone who feels
they
as though...
Call me. A Luddite, actually, I'm closer. There's an organization called the Neo-Luddites, which have annual conferences. And they're not they're anti-technology folks. And some of them are relatively well-known. I would say that Wendell Berry, for example, is a Neo-Luddite, but I don't think he goes to the conferences. A misanthrope, it could be, but I'm not a fan of abstract words, especially not isms. Misanthrope, this fellow, Pentti Linkola, eco-fascist because he believes that an ecologically minded dictator should take over. Eco-fascist, is that fascism? No, I think that one could describe him in a better way if one wanted to. Mm-hmm. Than throw out an ism. It just simply has become, in the human use of language, facility is what matters. So give it an ism. Give it an ism and go and do something else.
It reduces us to the confines of that word.
Yeah, which are narrow confines.
So is there an ism that you do identify with?
Let me think. No one has ever asked me that question before. I that requires a bit of thought. Let's see. I would have had you would have to have asked me that in advance, because there really, I can't think of one off the top of my head. But if I burrowed into the depths of my head, I might come up with an ism. And that perhaps you can utter an ism that I would go for.
Sure.
Like, I can think of one. I just wrote an article. This is going to be off-putting to some people. Cannibalism.
Okay.
And when the article was about one way we can reduce the population of the planet is by eating each other. I don't go into depth about that. What happened was I was in the Arctic, and an Inuk, and that's singular Inuit, told me that during a period of starvation, he'd been obliged to eat another Inuk. And I said, oh, how did he taste? And he said, like inferior polar bear meat. And then for some weeks after that, I couldn't look at my fellow human beings without thinking, inferior polar bear meat. But then, and this is in the article, I started thinking, well, this might be a solution. And I didn't mean like Ed Gein or the Donner Party or Idi Amin or Jeffrey Dahmer. I meant, you know, casually eating one's own kind. I didn't have a way of doing that. I offered it in the article, and I also wanted to see how we tasted, and it didn't work out. So I tried a little tiny piece of my thigh, and as I said in the article, I didn't seem to have much flavor.
So the prediction was correct.
I was inferior polar bear meat, but then what happened was I ate a polar bear in Greenland, and I thought it tasted quite good, superior human meat, perhaps. But then when I concluded the article by saying, and as a result of this, I had a much higher opinion of my fellow human beings, at least for a while.
Nice.
So cannibalism, maybe, but again, there are asterisks there. I mean, you know, my closest friends, I would probably not deign to eat.
I hear you. I am thinking a little bit along the lines of these travelers that you've met, the members of tribes that exist and don't exist any longer. They've told you a lot of tales. A lot of your books are retellings of those tales. That word there is key, retelling. You write that you don't necessarily tell the tale exactly as it was told to you. Sometimes you might combine stories or adjust some of their details. You almost received permission for that with from someone who told you, and you write about this in A Kayak Full of Ghosts, one of your books, that a story is not true unless the storyteller puts something of his own in it. How has that been for you as a writer and as a retailer?
First thing, in terms of these stories, you know, memory often plays tricks on one, and a lot of the storytellers are retelling something they heard and changing it just automatically because it's impromptu telling. And often what I want to do, I can maybe unconsciously make a change if I feel that change will get me closer to the truth. So paradoxically, I might not repeat exactly what the person said, but I'll write more or less what he or she said because I find that my more or less gets me closer to the truth, you know, the real idea than if I just said, made a few adjectives. And again, that's personal because I'm evaluating myself with truths.
And it suggests there that the truth is the effect to be had on the reader, more so than the content of the story.
It might be the effect that was had on me as the listener, which I then want to give to the reader. And, you know, this is true not only for traditional tales that I've heard, but for my retelling of an experience that I have. I won't totally falsify it, but I might add something in it that for instance, in the story about cannibalism, I simply added, I thought, well, maybe a recently deceased human being would be interesting to taste. I went to a pathologist friend and said, I'd like to determine, the flavor of human beings. So in the story, I changed it. So I wrote, I'd like to see if human beings do, in fact, taste at all like inferior polar bears. And then he said, no, it's illegal. But what I wrote was, he said, you must be nuts. He didn't say that, but his look said that.
Hmm.
And so that's what I wrote in the article.
That's a really good example.
And it's still, I call it nonfiction. It gets out, in a way, I could say, look baffled, or he glowered. But having him say, you must be nuts, gets at the essence.
There's also the element here that the tales you're telling in these books that are going to be read mostly by a Western audience in living rooms and cities are not, the stories are not being told in the same place or in the same setting, conditions, and on that the stories were born. These also are stories that we might note are pretty drastic, many of them. They're gory, they're violent, and off-putting, at least to the untrained eye. I want to read here something from the intro again to Kayak Full of Ghosts. You write about a night that you spent with an Eskimo storyteller named Ken at Baffin Island in northern Canada, and how he started telling you stories there in that setting. There was a snowstorm. You guys basically were unable to go outside. And you write, I remember thinking that this was how stories ought to be told, during rip-roaring weather, over an abundance of meat, surrounded by a sawtooth of crags and ice age glaciers, and not, I hasten to say, during the so-called poetry reading undergone in the parlors of academe, which by comparison seems like so much polishing of mahogany.
Yes, I would still support that 30-some years later. And it's interesting that many northern cultures, storytelling occurs mostly in the winters or in lousy weather when they're not out and about in the natural world, hunting, foraging, whatever. That in conditions like that, I would say that on a day, if I said to someone, there is a herd of caribou in the distance, and if I said to an Inuk, why don't you tell me a story about a herd of caribou? He'd say, no, I have to hunt. Which is another way of saying that is reality matters more than what we say. The real world, not.
So the stories are, the stories are an aid for then returning out into the world.
It's a survival mechanism, especially the Inuit stories in the book you mentioned, *The Kayak Full of Ghosts*. A lot of them dark humor, very dark humor with ending in a sort of bleak, jocular way, and the dark humor is a survival mechanism. Dark or otherwise. It helps us deal with situations And I often told people, as COVID was initially embracing the planet, that the best medicine was laughter, because instead of twisting yourself into a knot of anxiety, just having a sense of humor about it will aid and abet your immune system. Instead of being anxious, which has a negative effect on one's immune system,
it assists us in extracting ourselves from the tragedy of a situation to observe it from afar, kind of like what theater did in its early days, to observe folks going through a difficult time, a drama, an odyssey.
No. True. Very true.
So I'd like to ask you a little bit as well about some of the discoveries that you made along the way. I know you've discovered a lake and also a fungi that was for many years thought to be extinct. Is that right?
Yes, it is. I co-discovered it with a mycologist friend. And it was thought to be extinct because the tree on which it grew was constantly being cut down. Initially, 110, 120 years ago, it wasn't considered a rare species. But when you would eliminate something from the environment, a fungus that grows on that something can be considered a rare species or proclaimed extinct. And this was growing on a tree called the Atlantic White Cedar, which grows along the coast of eastern North America. And it only grows on old growth Atlantic white cedars, but the tree was being cut down and used house building and shipbuilding, etc. And it wasn't allowed to reach an old growth status. So the fungus was not around. But then, away from 125 miles inland, which is about as far inland as you find Atlantic white cedar swamps, I was with a friend, and we found some old growth trees, harder to cart such wood 125 miles than if it's growing near the coast. And there we found a bunch of this. I'm sure this is not going to be important to most of your listeners, but it's a polypore called Echinodontium bluei. And the first person who described it was something of a mycologist, but he was an individual who purported to be a scientist named William Jose Ballou, who wrote, faked his background, gave himself a doctorate. He didn't have faked expedition to the Arctic. He never went in search of Dolphus Greeley. And he wrote papers that were accepted for publication, where he said things like, well, it's quite obvious that stegosauruses could fly. Anyway, he did mention, first one to describe, mentioned this species, and he mentioned it as a serious parasite of these trees, but in fact, it's not. It only grows on trees that are past their prime and on the way out. So it's what's called the saprophyte.
This comment describing the animal, the fungi in this case, as parasitic was used to justify its elimination, its extinction?
I would not say that. But this is a very interesting supposition, because he did things like that. And I've written about him, I've written about this, but I congratulate you on coming up with that. I've just essentially indicated his ignorance. He found this in an area in central New Jersey, where it hadn't, in a swamp that hadn't been destroyed. But that's quite a good supposition. I might steal it.
You have my permission.
Yeah. Often, Lauren, by the way, with respect to mythology, science, and so on, the best ideas I get are from people who are outside the discipline, who can see a bigger picture than those who are stuck inside, whether they're metaphoric or not, four sterile walls. And, you know, and I can see this, there are many analogies. Going out and looking for fungi, people who are not experts tend to find more than people who are. Whose eyes are limited to, you know, what exactly they're looking for, and they don't see other things of similar interest that are next to what they're looking for. So your comment definitely a significant part of this Zoom.
Great. I'm glad to contribute to your research and to the field of mycology. I wonder if you could explain what is the field of mycology and also answer the question about whether fungi and fungi are both valid pronunciations, if you would.
I will start out by saying they're both valid pronunciations. I will also continue to say I use fungi. There's fungi and mushroom. Now, a mushroom-shaped mushroom is also called a fungus. But a polypore, i.e. a bracket fungus, or the species I talked about, mentioned to you on the Atlantic white cedar, strictly speaking, is a fungus, but not a mushroom. But if one wants to be, I prefer being informal. I lead dozens of walks a year. Intermittently, I use mushroom and fungus, and they're advertised as mushroom walks, even though they're at a time of the year when they're just fungi and not mushrooms. We will now segue to your question. Mycology is the study of fungi, i.e. mushrooms. And, you know, it is a area, it's a discipline that is all in ways all-inclusive. It includes amateurs who just like to collect things to eat. And if they do this in a way that doesn't result in them getting sick all the time, they could be called mycologists. And an academic, someone who's if shown a picture of a mushroom, it would scratch his head, say, what bloody hell is that? Because all they're working on is DNA and, you know, phylogenetics and sequencing, little bits of tissue that determine, okay, what does this, you know, evolutionary connection, what is this connected with most in, you know, the fungal world? And I've had often experiences with academic mycologists who I've showed something that they've studied to them. And they wondered what it was because they only know the sequencing. They don't know the reality. And I mean, this is an opportunity too to segue to my having left the world of academia. I did. Sure.
So before we go to you leaving it, what was your foray into it, the world of academia?
Well, I went to Washington University in St. Louis, and I was going to major in archaeology, but the fellow who I wanted to study with was doing worse. His name was George Millimaus, and he was in Greece on a two-year sabbatical. So that was, there were no archaeologists around. And I was also interested in marine biology, but being in St. Louis, you know, one couldn't walk directly to a beach and look at the shells that were washed up. And I suppose by process of elimination, I ended up with English. Because I had always been interested in writing and literature. And that's where I got my degree. And then I went on to get a doctorate in English. And, you know, occasionally people call me doctor, but, you know, I apply, sorry, I know nothing about surgery. But what happened was this. By the time I got my doctorate, I had my fill of the academic life. So I went to live in the west of Ireland, where people live by the spoken word rather than the written word.
Was this, Lawrence, your first time living out of the country when you went to Ireland?
Yes, it was the first time living out of the country. I'd been to Ireland before for a month or two, and I'd been to Europe for a month or two. But in Ireland, I lived for 2 years, and I hung out around with traditional storytellers. And slowly but surely, I put together material for my first book. Our life will not be there again.
You then returned to the United States, or did you continue living abroad?
I returned to the United States, and I got occasional teaching jobs. But I did not want to be in a position to be evaluated for tenure. What I wanted was a 1 year job where I would get enough money that would allow me to go traveling for the next year. And then I would come back. So I taught, and I taught for a while at Goddard in the MFA program. And there were only residents. So I ended up spending quite a bit of time like an IC. But I could come back for the residency. And what was nice about a residency is you did not have to be umbilically affixed to the institution for a lengthy period of time, just 2 weeks.
How many of those MFAs did you do then? The residencies, rather? 1, 2 years?
Well, I did. I taught at Goddard for... we think it's 4 years, but and 2 residencies a year.
Got it. Did you continue on to other roles in academia, or was that after your exit?
After that, I ended up, where did I go? I taught before that, I actually had taught for a year at the University of Minnesota and at Tufts University. And then I taught, because I really liked Iceland, at the University of Iceland. I had a Guggenheim Fellowship, and that was by far the best of all my teaching experiences, because I had really interested, eager students rather than Tufts. You know, they were all, just waiting for the time when they would take over daddy's business. And the students in Iceland appreciated my eccentricity. For instance, I always wanted to teach particular books in something akin to the place where they were written. So I taught Walden in the Reykjavik swimming pool, which was the only body of water in Iceland where one could sort of semi-submerge oneself. And it was a simulacrum of Walden Pond. And I had students who were held the book, and they were half, up to the waist in water, and we were talking and so on. I wanted the experience to have a pond-like quality. And then there was a chap doing laps, and he was listening to us. He was Icelandic, and at one point he got up and puffed some water at me and said, "I am Moby Dick." And I raised my hand and I said, "I am Captain Ahab." And then he looked at me and he said, "No, you're not. You have 2 legs. And we became friends, and he was a bush pilot, and he took me to Greenland several times.
That is a great story for having someone.
If he had not puffed the spout of water on me, and if I had not said, "I am Captain Ahab," this wouldn't have happened. And I went to East Greenland and hung out with people who didn't speak English. And that was my introduction to collecting stories from the Inuit.
So how many years did you collect stories from the Inuit for? And why did you decide to stay at that for so long? It was in a brief experience for you. You spent many years collecting stories. Is that right?
Well, I, many visits rather than many years. I got a Guggenheim Fellowship for actually that book that you mentioned, Cars Full of Ghosts. And I spent a couple months here and a couple months there in different parts of the Arctic. I really didn't go to the Western Arctic. Never collected stories in Alaska, the Yukon, or even the western part of the Northwest Territories. I stuck to both in Labrador, both coasts of Greenland, northern Quebec, and what's now called Nunavut, formerly Northwest Territories.
You write about feeling a certain consciousness of your own background as a storyteller in these parts, not necessarily as one of those who the stories were originally made for. Also, you mentioned feeling as though the role of a white man there might be questioned. What was the experience there for you as an outsider telling these stories and collecting them?
Well, one of the great experiences, one of the nice experiences I noted, a lot of academics believed, these are ethnographers, that if you want to collect information from people, you must live with them first. There was a fellow I knew at one of the institutions, I shan't mention his name, who emptied chamber pots in Greenland for Greenlanders as a way of initiating himself to them. And what I found was just walking up and saying hello and using their languages. And in East Greenland, or West Greenland, I was walking down a little dirt road, and there was a 20-something fellow sitting on a rock drinking beer. And he said, mixture of languages, Kalu means white man. Hello, Kalu, fuck you. And then, he was a native of this little village, and I said, and I mentioned that word in Greenlandic, hello, fuck you too. And he laughed and gestured me over and gave me a beer, and we got to chatting, and it turned out that his father was really a story, real storyteller. And I hopped on to his, snowmobile. Off we went, and I collected stories from his father and traditional cures too. What plants to use to cure your whatever disease it is.
Is there a lesson there in your response? I think there's some similarity between the way you responded to him, cursing him as well, and similarly to the man in the pool in Iceland that you responded to with humor.
Humor, exactly. And that helps so much in terms of dealing with, I was going to say traditional native people, but I think it has to do with traditional. A fellow in the pool was not a traditional native people. In fact, he was an pilot who made his living in Iceland by transporting medical goods from one community to another. But humor matters, and it just comes out like that. I didn't think, what should I do in order to ingratiate myself? It just, because that was me saying, fuck you. And I thought, and I knew at the bottom of my throne of wisdom, i.e. my brain, that if I said, fuck you, he would laugh, not get angry. And I said, and I used some his own words as well, which most white men who are visitors would not have used.
Yeah. What was that process like learning these languages? You mentioned that they don't have anything to do sometimes with English etymologically. Was it strange learning them?
Well, it was. And not strange, but what happened, it was sort of more like what would happen to people long ago when, there weren't quadrilingual individuals in the world. I was obliged, if I wanted to hang out with people or, get stories from them, to learn their language. And when I was in East Greenland, one of the elders who who was sort of teaching me, and he knew a little bit of English because he had Americans had been there in during the there had been a station during the Second World War in this village, Kuvasuk in East Greenland, and you know the Americans had it on the top of the hill. They had their station, a bunch of soldiers, and this fellow had learned American English to some extent because he drove what was called the pussy wagon. In other words, he drove the truck that transported some local girls up the hill to the American soldiers. So what he did, and it worked out, it's very appropriate, he started teaching me the equivalent of four-letter words in East Greenlandic. This means this means that, et cetera. And the reason it worked out was so many traditional stories from Greenland and other parts of the Arctic have a sort of R-rated quality. And often an R-rated and a humorous quality.
Is that immediately evident in the darkness of it? I've read a couple of those stories, and you know they involve amputating body parts. Some of those stories, or sudden deaths, violence. Where is the humor? Is it always evident, or must one really imagine it?
Read a few more. No, you mustn't imagine it. If I wanted to, I could go get the book and read you a story or two. But rather than do that, let me just tell you and tell your listeners to get a copy of the book, and you'll read about all sorts of things that are a bit bizarre and transformations of humans into animals and so on. And it has a dark humor. It's not like what should we say, stand-up comedians. It's more dark humor. It's more, and a bit of satire, too. But a lot of it also in that book is I picked up on the look on the face of the storyteller. So he may be saying something about, an individual who was beheaded or had his legs cut off or something, but there would be a whimsical expression on his face that made me give my telling of the story a slightly whimsical quality. I experienced it, and I wanted the readers to experience it. And the mere words only went so far.
Where did you learn to not just write? I gather that you learned that through perhaps one or both of your degrees, but the act of translating...
I didn't learn it through my degrees. I learned it as opposed to my degrees.
I can imagine. Go ahead.
I didn't take a single writing course. I wrote on the side, whereas the teachers were, stuck in... here, this has a TS-08 has 33, this poem has 33 types of ambiguities. And that had nothing to do with what I was writing. So it was sort of in opposition. I'd often like to think of myself as someone who works in opposition, unless I happen to be in a traditional culture. And in opposition to that academic world, and finally, you could argue that my visits to the west of Ireland writing about storytelling there was in opposition to the academic world. But I think I learned about storytelling. There were a lot of really good books when I was growing up in my parents' library. Everything from Rachel Carson to Mark Twain to Robert Frost. I mean, a lot of very good. So at a very young age, I was introduced to literature, and at a young age, I decided, I'm going to try to be like these folks.
then the skill had to be added of translating spoken stories into written ones. You didn't read the stories that you then retell. Perhaps some of them you did, I'm not sure. But what was
I saw earlier versions of them, yes. I saw earlier versions, but I stuck more to the ones that I listened to.
And what is that action like, writing something that's been spoken before? You mentioned before having to convey some of the tone or the facial expressions in the writing. What else, what other obstacles did you find in that experience?
Well, I haven't mentioned obstacles. I'm going to mention when I was first doing this in the west of Ireland, taking down a story from an old lady. She said, "We really believe that if you write down a story, you will destroy it." So dedicated she to oral tradition and the telling of stories, she thought I was turning it into something else. And in a way, I was, because it wasn't immediate. The way a face-to-face contact with the person who's telling the story is immediate. And so I, you know, on one level, I'm aware of that, but on another level, what I wanted to do was I see so many cultures dying out. I wanted to preserve lore. And it's not just stories, but in some of my books, I talk about cures and beliefs and wisdom. The Inuit, for instance, and this is a book I highly recommend, even though I'm being a bit mercenary, called At the End of the World. And I talk about how missionaries came and destroyed the Inuit belief that everything has a soul. And one man told me he used to believe that trees, drift logs, and birds, and fish, and snails, and even anak, which is the Inuktitut word for shit. All of those had a soul. And then the missionaries came. No, nothing has a soul but us human beings. And we only have souls for Christians. And so I wanted to preserve the world before the missionaries made statements like that.
Before stories came in to supplant those that were here before?
Before different things like biblical stories supplanted oral stories, yes. I'd never collected biblical stories.
Sure.
It would have been against my sensitivity.
So every culture has stories, not just those that came before the missionaries, right? Our current culture has stories too that help us operate, that lend us some sort of guidance, whether helpful or unhelpful, through this life. Do you have fondness for any of our current stories, or particular disdain for any of the stories that drive our
concern? What I would like to know is, I'm going to change this briefly into my asking the question of you. Give me an example of a current story.
One story that comes to mind is the story that if we work hard, we will be well. This is not necessarily a story with characters or a plot. It's a story we have come to believe is true, and that we have come to believe is true about others as well, that merit leads to well-being and success.
Well, unfortunately, I would not consider that a story. I would consider it a belief. And a belief, perhaps, I will use a capitalistic belief, that work is what matters. Whereas work, for me, is the very worst of all four-letter words. You know, I think of a story as something, and I talked to Native people, they told me stories that would last an hour or more. They have it in their heads. And that's what, to me, is a story. It's one with characters. It's one where the person, and when you say, what you say, often not accompanied with any sort of shift of expression on your face, the way the traditional stories I collected and wanted to preserve in my writing. And actually what I did with, this was in the day of cassette tapes, you know, cassettes. They've since gone extinct, although I still do listen to music on my cassette recorder and my cassettes. I have given all sorts of cassettes, several hundred, to the School of Irish Studies at Boston College. And these are recordings I made for storytellers. And then songs I collected in the Hebrides of Scotland. I gave to the School of Scottish Studies. And then just conversations I've had with not native people, but my own Caucasian types who spent time in these remote places. One of whom was an author who was a dear friend of mine and named Elliot Merrick, M-E-R-R-I-C-K. And I actually wrote the introduction to the reissue of three of his books. And one of them, his wife was a nurse. It's called Northern Nurse. It's about her time in Labrador, absolutely superb. Anyone who's even remotely interested in nursing and traditional cultures should read M-E-R-R-I-C-K. Would talk to him and take notes. And I wrote about him in, one of my most recent books is called The Last Speaker There. And I have a little essay about him in that. But I gave tapes of him and a whole bunch of his letters to me. And these were written letters. One of the things about letters nowadays, there aren't any collections of letters by contemporary writers because they only write emails. And email collection of letters of so-and-so, that wouldn't matter. But I gave a collection of his letters to me, which were probably about 100, to the Labrador Institute.
Lovely. You have a new book coming out in the next few months called Outsider, My Boyhood with Thoreau. And this is a mini-memoir, around 60 pages. Why did you decide to write a memoir? Is this a new genre for you?
Very new genre for me. And I decided to write a memoir, a couple of reasons, but one of them was that I had never written one before. And, I've dipped into all sorts of literary areas. Another which is I felt that, a desire suddenly to talk more personally about myself in my writing. People would say, tell me more about yourself, sort of the way you're doing in this interview. But what I first did was I wrote a 250-page memoir that went from the very beginning to the end. And it was just fine for the first 60 pages. Then I ended up in academia, and it became a series of rants. I mentioned in one of them, one of the professors at Washington University, I said it looked like his hobby was disemboweling grandmothers. So imagine, and then I talked about being with traditional people and would rant against the effects of the outside world against them. And then I would rant against my mother for criticizing my every act. And I finished this, and then I read it, and I realized, first of all, a book-length memoir was not my cup of tea. Because I was saying more or less what I felt, but I wasn't fleshing it out with, shall we say, genteel things. And I went back and thought, okay, better to just simply write an origin. this is how I came about. This is how I became how I am. And stop before I went to college.
And was this process of finding the origin of your life, was this something you knew before you started to write, or was it more a process of discovery throughout the process of writing?
Both. I knew, by thinking about it, I excavated various moments of my youth that I hadn't remembered for years by writing them down. When you write, a certain thought automatically leads you to the next thought, which leads you to the next thought, and so on.
Sounds as though you were writing the stories of your life. Most of them are pretty short and sweet.
Yeah, well, because they were short and sweet, but I wanted them to be like that. Because as I said in the introduction, my memory of my childhood is not a consistent narrative so much as a series of moments here and there.
Sure. The title includes the author of Walden, which you mentioned earlier, Thoreau, and he has experienced a bit of a resurgence in our current century. To those who have not read him yet, or who have just recently learned of him and read him, what would you say about him to encourage folks to lend him an ear?
He died in 1862, but he seems to me much more alive than almost all of my contemporaries. And I say that in this memoir, but I read him and it seems like he's talking about the present world and the destruction of the natural aspect of it.
So he's not just prescient, but also descriptive of our current times.
Oh, yes. Yes, exactly.
Is there anything I haven't asked you or anything you'd like to say?
Well, I can think about 15 more hours of things that I could say in terms of my talking about myself as a writer. And there's part of my writing that relates to humor that we haven't talked about that was satirical. And I've written several satirical books, starting with one called Paris is My Fair, which, I mean, you know, it's hard for me. There's certain things, if something's popular, I feel obliged to make fun of it. And Paris is My Fair more is a series of imaginary diaries, one of which is God's diary, which I happen to have found in Anthill, Israel. So the introduction says. And then another diary is editor's diary, these are letters that I purportedly found, one of which was to a man named Hitler. Thank you for sending us your book, My Camp. But I think it would be more appropriate for a more genocidally interested publisher. Then I wrote a book called The Book of Origins, which are imaginary origins of certain things, you know, at least 100 things, all of which are 1 to 2 pages. And I could not have written this book without having spent time collecting stories of Native people who wrote a number of different who had a number of different origin stories.
Got it.
So I should mention that. More or less, as an aside.
A lot to discover in your oeuvre, many different genres and stories told and retold.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lawrence. But before I ask you some rapid-fire questions, before we close, I'd like to remind our listener to please rate, subscribe, or follow the show if you've enjoyed today's conversation. Thank you. Lawrence, a couple rapid-fire questions. You don't have to think too much about them. We'll try a couple out, see which ones land. What is your favorite time of day?
I really prefer the nighttime. I don't like the bright sun in the sky. I'm not a sunny person. My favorite time actually is up in the north as the sun is sort of slowly becoming the night, and it's a grayish purple color all around. And I find that far more aesthetically pleasing than the bright sun.
If you weren't a human animal, what animal would you be?
Organism. I'd be a mushroom. Probably a mushroom. Fungus. There are any number of them that I would say would be more preferable to a human being. I don't know where to start, I wouldn't be a dog, because I see dogs as having been so domesticated. You could call them babies in a furry disguise, whining and complaining. And what they do is they cause the oxytocin of any number of people to rise to Everest-like heights. I would much rather, I much prefer non-domesticated animals. So a wolf over a cute Pekingese any day of the week.
Is there a part of the world you haven't seen yet that you'd like to discover?
It's not so much a part of the world as certain islands. And there's an island called Kristin de Cunha in the South Atlantic that I'd like to visit. It's a bit off the map, although it's now increasingly visited by cruise ships. I would like to go, in fact, to Tierra del Fuego, which happens to be somewhat south of you, but farther south of me.
Nice.
Where else? It's mostly places I would like to return to. And, you know, both because I had remarkable experiences there and because I'm vaguely curious about how much they've changed since then.
Favorite food?
Favorite food is very interesting. I really, I like off-meat foods. And one of my favorite foods is what's called helkarth, which is rotten Icelandic shark's meat. You know, the shark cannot, don't eat it right away because it doesn't have any urinary outlet. It urinates through the pores of its skin, so it has a rich maniacal flavor. So bury it in the ground, gets rid of that, then dig it up, dry it, and eat it. And that's called helkarl, H-A-K-A-R-L. I really like it. But writers, Anthony Bourdain, the food writer, said it was the worst food he'd ever eaten.
Great.
But I'm always on the outside with respect to foods. I mean, Big Macs are the worst food I've ever eaten.
Sounds oppositional, definitely.
Yes.
And as a final question here, do you have a song you'd recommend?
A song?
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't follow pop songs very much. So I'd have to give this some thought. Yes, I do. It's a child ballad. C-H-I-L-D-E. Francis Child was a collector of songs in Scotland at the turn of the 20th century. And this is a ballad called Sheath and Knife. S-H-E-A-T-H and Knife. And if we go online, it's a singer called Helen Schneer. You'll have to look that up. Sings it. And it's a wonderfully rich, old Scottish ballad. Sheath and Knife are symbolic about king's son who has an affair with his sister. He's the knife, she's the sheath. I won't tell you the outcome, but it is, I'd say my favorite song.
A song with a story.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Lawrence, for coming on and for the conversation today.
And thank you for your splendid questions.
Thanks for sticking until the end. If you enjoyed this conversation, please take 6 seconds to rate or follow the show, or share this episode with someone you think would enjoy it. Visit our website at resonantradio.org to find transcripts and a link to join Resonant Radio Plus, where you can get access to a monthly discussion group, extra episodes, and the opportunity to submit questions for future guests. Your voice matters in shaping our conversations, so please share your thoughts on social media or by writing to info@resonantradio.org. The music you hear at the start and end of the episode is Meditation by Jules Massenet from his 1894 opera, Thaïs. It's performed by Misha Elman on violin and Josef Bonim on piano and recorded on November 10th, 1919 in New York. The 100-year-old audio track was quite grainy, but the sound engineers at the pop band Amantes managed to fix it up nicely. Meditation is in the public domain. Thank you.